Greetings again, everyone. We all know that the tinderbox that could ignite World War III is in Palestine and the city of Jerusalem. I find it highly significant that, as we are here today, the Pope is in Lebanon. The Pope is in the Middle East. If you've been watching your news recently, you saw the armored caravan, the Hope-mobile, surrounded by armored cars, and they have 20,000 armed soldiers providing security for the Pope in the streets of Beirut, a ruined city that has endured many, many years of protracted civil war between the Maronite Christians and factions of the various Islamic religion, both Sunni and Shiite. And there are four major factions that exist over there, but here is the very first time in all of history that a Roman Catholic Pope has gone to the nation of Lebanon. He is there, of course, as the Prince of Peace. He is there making speeches about peace, about people living in brotherly love. And for the time being, both sides, that is, Islamic adherents and the so-called nominal Christians, the Maronite Christians, have said that it's a good thing, although some people are warning, among them Jumblatt, who is the head of the Druze, if you know very much about the Druze religion, is saying that it'll probably just fuel the fires of extremism on both sides when all is said and done, and just ignite a lot of the hatred and the passion that is still there as a result of what has happened in recent years in Lebanon. It was in 1982 that Israel invaded Lebanon, as you may remember. They have done so literally twice, and they occupy a portion of the southern Bekaa Valley, even now, as a part of the buffer zone that they are maintaining because of repeated attacks across into northern Israel from some of the Palestine refugee camps that have been maintained in southern Lebanon. I think all of you know that after the 1967 Six-Day War, there were tens of thousands of Palestinian refugees who fled to Jordan, to Egypt, to the Gaza area, and of course up into southern Lebanon, as well as to many other countries. And during all of that period of time, none of these Arab states have allowed the Palestinian Arabs, they are the same peoples oftentimes, they are Hashemites, and that comes from a term, Ishmaelites, and they themselves acknowledge that they come from Ishmael, who was the son of Abraham. So they know they have common roots with Abraham, and they say that very clearly, as King Hussein did when he visited the bereaved families of the young schoolgirls who were shot down by a deranged Jordanian soldier a few weeks ago, when he talked about our father Abraham, speaking of both Jews and Christians. When the Israelis occupied Lebanon, they did so to drive out Yasser Arafat and the PLO. You may remember the scenes of them being forcibly embarked aboard ships to take them to Cyprus, and how eventually the PLO was simply forced to get out of the area. And of course, the Maronite Christians had quite a terrible bone to pick with them, and so some of the worst problems that have ever affected the Israeli military, including their Air Force, came along as a result of Sharon and others who stood aside and allowed some of the Maronite Christian phalangists of Lebanon to enter into two refugee camps on September 14th of 1982 and to literally shoot down hundreds of unarmed men, women, and little children. We saw pictures of their bloated bodies lying tangled in the streets and in doorways. The Israeli soldiers were standing about outside with their armored cars and tanks while the Maronite Christians went into the camps. They could hear the gunfire rattling all over the terrain. No one did anything. As a result of that, near mutiny occurred in the Israeli armed forces. For the very first time, fighter bomber pilots disobeyed the orders of their superiors, refused to bomb selected targets in the Bekaa Valley or the environs of Beirut, where suspected terrorist Shiites and those of the Hezbollah, which are, of course, financed by Iran, were supposed to be holed up because they weren't sure of what is called collateral damage. They weren't really sure that their high command had pointed out targets that were, in fact, terrorists or whether they were civilian targets and that there were men, women, and children there. They dumped their bombs in the Mediterranean. For the very first time, soldiers were disobeying orders of their commanders in the Israeli army. And for the very first time since their War of Independence in 1948, Israeli citizens began protesting and demonstrating against their own government and against that war in Lebanon. You probably have followed it, but like most Americans, Most Americans do not pay very much attention to what goes on in the Middle East. They see a little bit of a vignette coming across on television news. They see Benjamin Netanyahu and maybe Arafat when they come to the United States to be greeted by President Clinton and to shake hands, and they hear a little bit about it, but they don't really know that very much about what's going on over there or what it really means. Most of you are students of Bible prophecy, and you know that one full third of this book that I'm holding up here is prophetic. And you know that the greatest prophet who ever walked this earth was Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And you know that the main prophecies that we learn from Jesus Christ having to do with the time of the end, the time of the end of civilization as we know it, not the end of all of humankind, but the time of that transitional period of a great World War III, and eventually the heavenly signs and the day of the Lord and the second coming of Christ, that Jesus spoke very specifically and in very great detail about the many events that were going to lead to that time. Now, even if you didn't know, and most of you do know, and you've proved to yourself that the United States of America and the British Commonwealth of Nations, and I'm speaking now of their earliest colonists, and I'm talking about not the melting pot that the United States has become, of the hundreds of nations and races and ethnic groups that are represented and called Americans. I'm talking about the original colonies and all of the westward migration and the big migrations from the potato famine in Ireland. There were holding areas all over Europe, including people like the Eisenhowers. They might have a German name, but they are not the same kind of German people as live in Germany, as most people understand. So there were people of various other roots, ethnic roots. Many Americans will tell you, I am Scotch, Dutch, and Irish, or whatever. Well, they should say Scot. Scotch is a liquor, and Scot is a person. But they will say, I am English, or I am Irish, or I am Dutch, or I am an Italian-American, or whatever. But most of you do know, and you have proved to yourself, through history and Bible prophecy, that the United States of America is Manasseh, and that Great Britain is Ephraim. And that we are, collectively, the two of us, the one great nation that was prophesied to become the greatest single nation that had ever been, clear back in the book of Genesis, in the 49th chapter, in the 12th chapter, the 17th chapter, the 19th chapter, and the 22nd chapter, where the promises were repeated to Abraham and made absolutely unconditional after he almost sacrificed Isaac. But, having said that, even though you have proved that to yourself, and you know it, and you understand it, please also understand that there are hundreds of millions of people who reject that, including many Sabbatarians, including the Church of God Seventh Day, including some other groups, and including now the former parent organization, which denies the identity of the United States and the British Commonwealth and the democracies of Northwestern Europe as being Israelitish. They now have decided, just like most others, that they are of the tribes of Gomer, that perhaps they are Gentiles. All right, laying that aside, be that as it may, is there anyone in his or her right mind who thinks that a violent war could break out in the Middle East in which Syrian, Saudi Arabian, perhaps even Iraqi, Egyptian, and other forces were to launch silkworm and scud missiles laden with canisters of deadly anthrax, of biological and chemical agents, and these nations do possess them, and the rogue nations, which were not signatories to the ratification of the non-biological and chemical agent proliferation recently signed in Washington by our government, decried by many of the Republicans and other conservatives who said you can't police it, you'll never be able to trace it, you can't find these things that hide under the aegis of some kind of an insecticide factory or a fertilizer factory, you'll never be able to determine where they are, just like the UN was utterly frustrated in months and years of trying to ferret out the biological and chemical supplies of Saddam Hussein. What if a war were to break out in the Middle East? Is there anybody in his or her right mind who thinks that the United States would not be involved? Well, we always were in the past. As a matter of fact, we crossed swords with both Britain and France in the 1956 war when Nasser sent his troops across the Suez into the Sinai and occupied Gaza for a brief time. And you may remember some of the scenes of some of the ships that were actually sunk in the Suez Canal to block traffic, which was very important to Britain because, of course, Europe gets about 54% of its oil from the Middle East, and Great Britain at that time had not yet discovered North Sea oil. Well, the United States, for the first time, found itself crossways with both Britain and France and siding with the enemies of Israel and demanded that Israel withdraw, and the UN, of course, with the United States and Russia cooperating. For the first time, Russia and the United States were cooperating against Britain and France because Britain and France sent air and sea power into the region to help the Israelis open up the Suez and to get Nasser back out of the Sinai. Well, that's a matter of history. You can look it up and read it. I'm just talking from the standpoint of refreshing your memory about what a tinder keg this area of the world is and what biblical prophecy says about it. You're quite familiar with Matthew 24, but let me just give you a couple of quick verses, Matthew 24 and verse 15. Here in the midst of all of these many prophecies about wars, of droughts, of famines, and I have asked for decades, what is religious about a drought? Well, nothing. And I ask it that way to get people's attention focused on the fact that God's Word and the prophecies of Jesus Christ are real. They are actual. They are having to do with global geopolitics and with the pragmatic actions of various national sovereign entities that have great military forces and powers, and that oftentimes, even when he is talking about what we think are natural calamities, they are not necessarily natural. Men are now in possession of weapons that can literally wipe out whole populations, and recently we've been treated to some of the scientific statements about what could happen with even a light plane with one little canister of anthrax flying over Washington, D.C. that could wipe out hundreds of thousands of people in a matter of hours. They wouldn't die that quickly, but they would get the disease that quickly just by spreading those terrible active biological agents in the atmosphere above a city. He says, leading up to that, in verse 14, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. That does not mean to convert all nations. It does not mean a whimpering, simpering, oh, won't you come, brethren, kind of an appeal, like a heartbroken, poor, perturbed little Lord Jesus who has gone away from the earth and is heartbroken because people won't receive him or accept him. He says, this gospel of the kingdom, couched in what terminology? In the midst of this awesome, frightening prophecy of wars and rumors of wars, nation against nation, great empires, kingdom against kingdom, pestilences, that's disease epidemics, and they can be, as we know now, human engendered or caused by human weapons that are being manufactured right now as we sit here, and earthquakes in diverse places. I am not Chicken Little. And when I go through these prophecies with you, it is not because I want to say the sky is falling, let's all run out of here and get all excited, let's get paranoid, let's get fearful, let's be afraid about the ring of fire, and oh, there was an earthquake the other day somewhere up near the border of Afghanistan with Iran, and a lot of people died, a lot of villages and several cities have experienced heavy damage. We saw that this morning on television news. So we're about to have earthquakes in East Texas. No, that's not what I'm talking about. But Jesus Christ of Nazareth knew what he was talking about, and what he said applies to our day, our time, and the years and months just ahead of us. He said, this gospel, that's the good news of the coming kingdom of God. And right there, millions will just tune you out. Because the kingdom of God, well, that's off up there in the clouds with angelic little cherubic babies running around with wings and bows. And it has to do with long-faced saints. And it has to do with the other, never world of heaven. When the Bible actually says, even in the Annunciation to Mary, that he will inherit the throne of his father David and of his kingdom, there shall be no end. And Christ said repeatedly, I am coming again. And the first message that was ever sent back from heaven by an angelic messenger was while they saw him disappearing into the clouds. You men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? this same Jesus shall so come in like fashion as you have seen him go into heaven. Years ago, I was astonished when I found out that 44% of the graduates of America's religious seminaries that were to become preachers occupying the pulpits of dozens of different churches did not believe in the literal second coming of Jesus Christ. And when you stop to think about the concept of the immortality of the soul, that when someone dies, they immediately go to heaven or go to hell, why does Christ need to come back anyway? If he's got a soul factory going around down here, and every single day souls go up, souls go down, he's got it in place, it's working quite well, people are dying all the time, new kids are being born all the time, new souls come into existence, old souls going to heaven or going to hell, why does he need to interfere in the process? No wonder some of them don't believe it, because some of the fundamental doctrines in which they believe, which are false, do not really require it. But in those great events which are to shape up toward the intervention of God, divine intervention, interference in human affairs, Jesus Christ of Nazareth said there would be a work of witness and warning. And it's a witness against them. It's not a heartbroken appeal to them. Witness and warning. How many converts did Isaiah have? How many converts did Elijah have when fire came down and devoured the captains with their 50 at the foot of the mountain when he was being sought to be brought under arrest back to Ahab and Jezebel? How many converts did Elisha have? How many converts did Jeremiah have when he was put into a slime pit because he said, you are going to be taken in chains and you're going to die in a foreign land and this city is going to be overthrown and occupied? The prophets of God didn't have converts. They were sent to the leaders of their nations, of Israel and Judah, to warn them of what was going to happen because of the way they were living, because of the national and personal sins of the people, and because they had turned their backs on God and His laws. The good news of the kingdom is good news. But it's the good news of Christ coming to interfere in human events, to stop humankind from annihilating itself. And it is to be preached as a witness unto all nations. More on that a little later on, because there are two human beings somewhere on this earth today. I don't know whether they're 22 or 32 or 56. I don't know whether they're Catholic, Protestant, or Jew. I don't even know whether they are converted yet. I don't know if they have any religious background. I don't know their race, although I suspect they are either of the house or the tribe of Israel or of Judah. But they are mentioned in the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation, and they are going to have a greater impact on this world than any preachers, any prophets, including all of the great prophets of the past, a greater impact than Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, or Daniel, and a greater impact even than Elijah, who was able to cause plagues and drought to come upon the people against whom he prophesied. Because these two witnesses that are going to be in the capital of the great beast power, which is that city called Sodom and Egypt, as it says in Revelation 11th chapter, where also our Lord was crucified. These two human prophets are going to be the greatest prophets and do the greatest work a powerful warning and witness than any collection of anybody who has ever been on television or written books or booklets or articles or distributed sermon tapes or conducted sermons and Bible studies. Because they are going to immediately get the attention of the top leadership, the beast himself, the false prophet himself, and just like Moses and Aaron who walked in before Pharaoh and said, let my people go, and if you won't, this plague is going to fall upon you. So these two great witnesses are going to do exactly that. Specific things he pointed to, verse 15. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Matthew adds parenthetically, whoso readeth, let him understand. Why? Why the caution there? Be careful. If you read this, be sure to understand it. Then he says, and he goes on to describe, those who are in Judea ought to flee to the mountains. Those that are on the housetop, don't even come down to get your clothing. Those in the field, don't return to take your clothes, but just get out. and pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then, verse 21, shall be great tribulation, a time of great trouble between and among nations, a time of great warfare, of plagues, of drought and famine and pestilence, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be. In Luke 21 and verse 20, he says, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, then know the destruction thereof is nigh. Now turn back to Daniel, the 11th chapter, if you would, and in verse 31. This is the prophecy to which Christ referred, talking about the king of the north and the king of the south, and those were the Seleucidae of Syria and Ptolemy Soter of Egypt, and they were two of the four generals who inherited the now defunct kingdom of Alexander the Great. They waged war back and forth. You can read that both in Josephus, in Rawlinson's Five Great Empires, and in Rawlinson's History, as well as in a book called Ancient History in Bible Light by Dorothy Ruth Miller. A very excellent title, a very good book. And they will give you, all these various sources, a verse-by-verse historical fulfillment of every verse of the longest prophecy in all the Bible, which is Daniel, the 11th chapter. This is Antiochus Epiphanes that is being spoken of. He was characterized as Epimenes because Epiphany, you know, means a revealing or a coming out. The Epiphany of Christ at the time of his baptism to reveal that he was the Son of God, and when the Holy Spirit appeared like a dove and a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, hear ye him," is called Epiphany. Well, this man took a title that belongs to God. It really means, when he took the word Antiochus, Epiphany, or Antiochus Epiphanes, it was the glorious God revealed. That was the meaning of this pervert's name. He was insane. He was literally insane. His mother was described as half wild and half mad, and he was called Epimenes by other people because it meant Antiochus the idiot or Antiochus the insane. When he came into Jerusalem, this prophecy says, arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, talking about the Holy of Holies and the temple, and shall take away the daily sacrifice that the Levites were offering in the temple. And they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And they placed a statue of Jupiter Olympus in the Holy of Holies. And this madman forced people to sacrifice pigs in the Holy of Holies in the temple. They shall place the abomination that maketh desolate, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. And there were some vagabond renegade Jews that were actually going along with some of this. But the people that do know their God, the people that remain true to the true religion of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Moses, shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. So there is teaching, there is preaching, there is educating of the people going on. Yet they shall fall by the sword, and by flame, and by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now prophecy is dual, D-U-A-L. It has a previous fulfillment and a latter end time fulfillment. So there is type and anti-type. And that is very true of Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Because typically, the prophecies of terrible destruction of Jerusalem took place in the lifetime of those who heard Jesus' words by 70 A.D., when Jerusalem was destroyed, and once again the Romans defiled the temple. There have been seven times in all that Kiddo's Bible Cyclopedia points out and other historical sources in which a temple, there were two of them, remember, Solomon's temple that was destroyed and occupied by Antiochus Epiphanes. Later on, when it was completely destroyed, there was another temple that was built, and by the time of the days of Jesus Christ, it was called the Herodian temple. Then that one was destroyed by the Roman armies, and there is now very strong movements underfoot. We hear about it all the time. I have books on it, very serious books. One of them is about a $175 coffee table book of brilliant, beautiful pictures of the brazen pots and vessels, the brilliant priestly garments with the Urim and the Thummim, and it shows all the various sacrificial vessels that they're going to use. There are all kinds of rumors about the red heifer that is supposed to be being raised so that they can begin with some kind of cleansing rituals. And there are movements among some of the Jewish organizations the more conservative, orthodox, as well as others, Solomon Gershon, whom my son Mark interviewed, who was saying that, oh yes, we will very respectfully dismantle the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will do that brick by brick, he said. Well, we all know that if any Jew walks even up to the wall, near the outer wall of that Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Dome of the Rock, and even touches it, that it starts a gigantic riot of some kind, and no doubt bullets are flying and people get killed. But this man was telling my son, when he interviewed him in the streets of Jerusalem, right there you can see the Dome of the Rock in the background, yes, they want to dismantle those Arab mosques and build a Jewish temple in their place. Now, look at this prophecy in verse 40 to 45 of Daniel 11. What is the date? What is the time? At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen. You can read tanks and light armored vehicles today, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, that's Palestine. This king of the north, who was one of the four generals who succeeded Alexander, and eventually, through attrition and warfare, there was only one left, and the dominant power in the West was Rome. And the Roman Empire, and you can look up the chart that we have in the booklet about the beast of the apocalypse, had many different resurrections down through history. It was, in most cases, a Germanic empire with a Germanic head of state, but an Italian pope. And it was called the Holy Roman Empire. The Habsburgs, Otto the Great, Bismarck, Hitler, and cooperation through many of those centuries with the Roman Catholic Church, calling it the Holy Roman Empire. Once the individual of Antiochus Epiphanes is introduced in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, I want to go back to that in verse 20 and 21, then the personality never changes. And look at the personality and look at the one that he supersedes. If you look in Dorothy Ruth Miller and Rawlinson, as I said, it will give you detailed historical corroboration of this lengthiest of all biblical prophecies. It says, then shall stand up, verse 20, in his estate, and I don't recall right at this moment, and I don't have my old Bible with the notes in it would give me the name of the individual whom Heliodorus supplanted, but there was a man named Heliodorus who was the raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger or in battle. And he was poisoned to death. And you can read of that. Now, Heliodorus was a tax collector. When you go from one border to another in Europe, as I have done so many, many times all over Europe, you will see a word that will say Z-O-L-L, Zoll. That means custom. It means at the border you will have the usual barrier, and it will say Zoll. Well, the Hohenzollern family was the tax collector family, and the Kaiser came from the Hohenzollern family. And they were named because way back somewhere in their genealogy, there were tax collectors. And that's what their name meant. You know, the word shipwright means a maker of ships, and the word cartwright means a man who makes carts, and wheelwright, these are names that are in the United States. Wright merely means a workman, and so on. So you know the origin of names. Well, the Hohenzollern family, of course, the Kaiser, was eventually, after a very short-lived, weak Weimar Republic, replaced by Adolf Hitler. Now notice what happened. Verse 21, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, that was Antiochus Epiphanes in history, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. The old guard, Prussians, and the elite class of Germany despised Adolf Hitler. Those whom he rode roughshod over in order to finally claim the chancellorship utterly despised him. And finally, when he was given the blessing of some of those people, including even the elite corps of the German army, it was not because they really wanted to, it was because they had to. But it says he would be a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably or during a time of peace and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And that is exactly how Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany. Interesting that once the personality of Antiochus Epiphanes is revealed here in verse 21 of this lengthy chapter that spans hundreds of years in Daniel the 11th chapter, that personality never changes, and he is called the King of the North. And there is a shadowy type there of Adolf Hitler. Now, in verse 40 again, it says, at the time of the end, this King of the North, that I believe is the beast of Revelation 13, Revelation 17, and the beast power of the 10-nation coalition of very powerful military nations that are going to coalesce and form into a superpower that is going to move into the Middle East. At the time of the end, now look at chapter 12 and verse 1. And at that time, the same time, the time of the end, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Identical time with Matthew 24, 21, and 22. Such as was not from the beginning of the world of that time. They would mutually eclipse each other unless it's talking about the same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth. The Bible continually speaks of death as a profound, deep sleep. In 1 Corinthians 15, that term is used many times. Those which sleep in Jesus will he bring with him, etc. Those who are the dead in Christ, who sleep in Jesus. Many of them that sleep, they are dead. They are profoundly unaware of the passing of time. Though the human spirit is not dead, it is not conscious apart from the living fleshly human brain. They shall awake. Some to everlasting life, that's the resurrection promised by Jesus Christ in 1 Corinthians 15, and some to shame and everlasting contempt, to destruction, to judgment, and to be cast into Gehenna fire. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness, those who are doing the work of God, who have a part in the work of God, who are preaching and teaching and causing that people are converted and accept God's truth, as the stars forever and ever. The time element is what I'm getting at. Back in verse 41 now. He, this King of the North, shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. How many countries are there down there? Well, think of the Middle East, if you can, in your own mind's eye, if you have a picture of the geography in the area. You know that Turkey is the big Anatolian peninsula, and I'll do it in reverse so that you can see it, and it juts way out into the Aegean, and then right below that is the coast, the Phoenician coast, and there is Lebanon, and right immediately below that is Israel, and immediately to the east of that is Jordan, and down here is the Sinai, and over here just a little bit south and west is Egypt, and then on across there is Libya, the Cyrenaican Peninsula, and Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. The other direction, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, of course, Kuwait, and above that, Iraq, and on the other side of them, Iran. And these are all Islamic countries. Now, what do they have that we want? Well, the United States gets an awful lot of oil from Nigeria. We get a lot of oil from Mexico. We get a lot of oil from Venezuela. We get oil even from other places we do a little bit of business with here and there. And we get a lot of oil from domestic production. But 17% of our oil comes from supertankers from the Gulf, around the Straits of Hormuz, and two American ports, some of them right down here in Houston, where great huge supertankers dock and, of course, pump that oil ashore. So we depend about 17% for our oil and energy consumption, and it is prodigious every single day, upon the Middle East. But Europe, collectively, all of Europe, depends up to 54% upon Middle Eastern oil. But Japan depends up to 70% on Middle Eastern oil. One of the greatest concerns during the Iraqi-Iranian war that lasted for 8 solid years, and millions died in that war, and most Americans didn't even follow it. They almost knew nothing that was going on. All those artillery battles, all of that bloodletting and everything between those two nations. But one of the greatest concerns was that there would be a supertanker blocked on the part of Iran in order, or Iraq, either one, to retaliate against the other one to prevent the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz. And so U.S. Navy warships were actually, for a time during that war, escorting tankers in the Persian Gulf to keep the flow of oil coming from there. Now, when it says that the king of the south will push at him, this is something other than an armed military aggression. It does not seem to indicate in the Bible, when it says in verse 40, the very first few words, the king of the south will push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, that this is an armed military attack or an invasion or an occupation. Only about a month before the OPEC oil embargo, back in the early 1970s, one of the leading senators in our Congress stood up before the American Congress and said that he didn't believe that the Arabs would ever use oil as a political weapon. And about a month after he made that stupid statement, they did exactly that. I remember very well Mr. Bill Evans taking my car and coming back 4 hours later with a full tank of gas. You do too, I think. Don't you remember those long lines at the filling stations? And people were scared to death to let their tank get to 3/4 because all the publicity, all of the propaganda, what it really was, I think, that we heard was that the oil supplies are just practically gone. And, of course, it was not only the cutting off of the shipment of oil, but it was simply the cutting off at the wellhead of the production of oil. It wasn't that there weren't reserves in the ground. It was just that they were absolutely forcing the price up by just hurting themselves as well as the rest of the West. But eventually, the price skyrocketed, as you know, and then this golden stream of what were called petrodollars began to flow into those nations and to make some of them the wealthiest per capita nations on the face of the earth. Listen to this. Do you know that even after expending more than $5 billion in order to recover from the devastation of the Gulf War, little Kuwait, on a per capita basis, is the wealthiest nation in the world? Little Kuwait has free education all the way through college. Free. You don't pay a dime. Free dental. Free medical care. Free public services. Zero tax. No tax, no. No sales tax, no. No income tax. No inheritance tax. No tax in the entire nation of Kuwait. The only tax they have to pay is if one of their number goes abroad and comes back, they do have a customs duty that they impose on imported goods. That's the only tax a Kuwaiti pays. So much for the OPEC oil embargo, the hiking of oil prices globally, what it has meant to the Western economies. It dealt them a tremendous blow from which most of them have never really recovered. And if you want a clue as to what pushing at a king of the north would comprise, I think you have a clue there. Because these people sit on about 80% of the oil reserves of the world. And that is exactly why the United States went to war to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. It was all about oil. Because everybody knew that just like Hitler wasn't satisfied with partitioning Czechoslovakia, neither would Saddam Hussein be satisfied with his so-called 19th province of occupying Kuwait. But his next big ripe plum that he would seek would be Saudi Arabia. Which is why the United States has supplied Saudi Arabia, we're not only with advanced, very high-tech missile systems and with F-16 and F-15 Strike Eagle fighters and so on, but has also provided them with tremendous infrastructure and helped them in the building of many, many big air bases and military bases and so on in that country. When this great war breaks out, something causes it. What would cause a king of the south who was an Arab leader? Now, anciently, he was an Egyptian. Egypt is the most populous of all the Arab states. It is also one of the poorest. It has a tiny bit of oil exports as a result of the magnanimity of the Israelis who gave back the Sinai willingly when they didn't really have to. And when they did abandon the Sinai, after a formal peace treaty was signed, quid pro quo, we have a formal peace treaty, then we don't need, said the Israelis, to occupy the Bar-Lev line across the Suez Canal any further. We can withdraw all the way back to the borders of Israel. We can let the Egyptians have the Sinai. And the Israelis themselves had been down there actually drilling and producing and developing some of the oil production facilities in the Sinai. When they withdrew, it made Egypt immediately self-sufficient in oil and even gave them enough left over for export, which helped the national economy in Egypt. Will Mubarak, or his successor, fulfill the role of King of the South. I don't know yet, but I do know that when this latest big flap occurred, and when the emergency summit occurred with all the Arab leaders down at Sharm el-Sheikh, to which Clinton went, and then the secret meeting that took place between Mubarak and Assad, which scared the daylights out of everybody because they found out that Assad was the one that dictated that formal Cairo declaration after that hasty summit of only a very few months ago, and that it was virtually put into print unchanged, and it looked like, to many Western observers, that a resurrection of the United Arab Republic that had gotten started between Gamal Abdel Nasser and Assad way back in the 1960s was about to occur again. And they worry about Syria and Egypt cooperating because that would mean the end of the formal peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. Now look at the time setting of this. Look at the players who are mentioned here and those who are excluded. He, this beast power, after some kind of a provocation, will enter into Palestine. He's going to occupy it. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom. And Edom is Esau, and Esau is Turkey. Many of the Bible commentaries and historians believe that and accept that. And Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. The Moabites and the Edomites were prophesied, there's a prophecy in Isaiah that says this, to settle on their lees. The lees are the big sort of props that are underneath the big oaken wine kegs. And to settle on your lees indicates stability, indicates staying right where you are, not migrating or emigrating out from that land. It says, his taste remaineth in him, he is settled on his lees. And sure enough, the Edomites and Moabites are still where they always were, in the mountains just to the east and to the northeast of Israel. Probably means some of the people of Jordan and Iraq. And after all, the chief of the children of Ammon, Ammon is the name that was given to the capital city of Jordan to this day, Ammon, Jordan. He, this king of the north, shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, many of them, I've mentioned them all. And that can include North African countries. It can include Saudi Arabia and Oman and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Abu Dhabi and Dubai and so on. And the land of Egypt shall not escape. You have to ask yourself, why would a northern power of a non-Jewish state come in and occupy Palestine and at the same time occupy Egypt when these two have been intractable enemies for millennia, Arab and Jew? And you can only answer that question, this would only be true if the two of them were somehow cooperating. And that's where we are today. And we are only there as a result of the Camp David Accords and the signing of a formal peace treaty during the Carter administration on the part of Israel and Egypt. It says, the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now this is an old King James language, and it's talking about the treasures of gold, and there still are treasures of gold that are mindless. You can't even begin to put a price on the gold that came out of Tutankhamun's tomb and so some of the artifacts and the other things in Egypt. But Egypt is not known for gold today, and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians, and that does not mean the nation of Libya or the nation of Ethiopia. It's Cush and Put. And Cush and Put are probably Pakistan and India, shall be at his steps, and right across the Gulf is Pakistan from Saudi Arabia and the Straits of Hormuz. So it appears that the King of the North advances all the way in the Middle East into many different countries, including the land of Palestine. Now remember, when Jesus said, he that is on the housetop, let him not come down to take anything out of his house. Or he that is in the field, he's out there maybe with a hoe or a rake and he's working on his crops. Don't let him return into his home to take anything out of his home. The language seems to be that here is a situation that has obtained for some period of time. But suddenly, something new and different is in the air. It is a subtle inference or indication to this workman or the housewife who is up on the top of the roof in Jerusalem, putting up her laundry perhaps, that she had better not even take the trouble to go down inside, but to just go what was called the way of the roofs, they were all connected, and to find the ladder or the stairway at the end of all of them and to get into the street and just keep walking and go right on out And it says, pray that your flight be not in the winter or on the Sabbath day. This is not a populace that receives a warning a year or two in advance of a military buildup, or a month in advance, or a week in advance, or even hears an air raid siren. This is something where there is a force that is there, which does not appear to be imminently threatening, but suddenly something occurs which indicates to these people, uh-oh, this is different. I'd better get out of here, and if I want to save my life, I had better not even bother to go back home and to try to gather up my personal possessions. I better just whistle a little tune and just nonchalantly keep walking out of my field and down across the next field and into a little country lane somehow and get out of here. That's what Jesus seemed to indicate. There is very strong indication that it will not be armed aggression in order to destroy the Holy Land, because it is the King of the South, not a king of Jerusalem. And during the days of the armies of the Seleucidae and the Ptolemies of Egypt, the wars were fought by the Syrians and the Egyptians. And Palestine was always the helpless victim in the middle. And on some occasions they cooperated with the one victorious force, and on other occasions with the other victorious force. They had no choice. Whichever power was in the ascendancy was the ones with whom the Jews, and oftentimes the high priest himself, were forced to cooperate. It says, no, he shall enter into the glorious land. Now, which nation could gain more popularity in world public opinion by being at the helm of a major military rescue, a peacekeeping mission, to send massive troops into the Middle East in order to prevent the annihilation of the Jewish race? And you know, that is what they want to do. You know, one of the major sticking points on the PLO charter is that they have still not really taken the words out of there that they said they would about even recognizing that the State of Israel has a right to exist. And in the wars that have occurred, 1948 war, the 1967 Six-Day War, before that, of course, the 1956 war that I talked about, and then the 1973 Yom Kippur War and the war which is yet to come. The avowed intent of the combined Arab armies, six Arab armies attacked them in 1948, five major Arab armies attacked them in 1967, and the Jews ended up every single time merely gaining territory as a result. So who was on whose side? And the big squabble over there right now is because of the territory they gained in the 1967 war, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And as to whether or not they're supposed to be a part of Israel or whether or not they belong to the Palestinian Arabs, as you well know. So, when you really think about it, that scene over there today is ripe for a chaotic beginning of another war. And when it does get going, it makes me wonder whether or not there are not tens of thousands of people out here who have heard these same scenarios that I'm going over with you today, who have understood these same prophecies, who prove to themselves by laborious reading of rather weighty materials, United States and British Commonwealth in prophecy, and looking up some of the historical sources and demonstrating to themselves the truths of God's prophecies in the Bible, but somehow following their leaders, the little clay pipe instead of the old hickory flute, they've gone marching off the landscape into such things as embracing of the sign of the cross, abandoning the Sabbath, embracing the doctrine of the Trinity, abandoning the identity of Israel and the understanding of biblical prophecy, abandoning a powerful television or radio witness and warning message, and just shrinking and sinking down into a cynical meeting group or whatever day they decide they're going to worship upon, and apparently they can take their choice today, and just be a kind of a church and love everybody and cooperate with everybody else. But it makes me wonder, when the news comes flashing over that there is another major war that has been triggered because a Jewish group or a Jewish government which is going to overthrow the present government has eventually demolished the Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock mosques, and then a massive attack occurs by Syria and combined Arab forces against the Israelis. And this time, if there is massive loss of life, you know, that's what Hussein was trying to do. You do realize that, don't you? You know that he was trying to kill hundreds of thousands, don't you? He sent the Scuds. The Scuds were flying over Tel Aviv. And we were propagandized when we saw those Patriot missiles, and you saw them, I think, just like I did, the winking light, then you heard the explosion. Well, all it did was knock the engine and knock the warhead apart, but every one of those Scud warheads exploded and blew a crater in a neighborhood in Tel Aviv. We were over there, my son Mark and Charlie and I were over there not too long after that, and if we had wanted to, although I think that they didn't want tourists and they'd seal it off, they didn't want people going to those demolished neighborhoods. But there were many Jews who died, including even some elderly ladies that suffocated in putting their gas masks on. Now, why do you suppose they were issued gas masks? Can you imagine the entire population? Do you imagine what that cost the government? There was not a man, woman, or child in all of Israel that did not have his or her personal gas mask during that attack. And when they knew the Scuds were coming in, they put them on. The specter of gassing Jews to death is something the world cannot handle. Germany, at the helm of a United States of Europe, whether or not under the aegis of a United Nations as a peacekeeping force, is the most logical force to march into the Middle East and to enforce peace before a huge, hideous World War III involving even such great powers as China, Russia, and Japan could get started. Now think about it. Somebody, somewhere, somehow, does something which precipitates a King of the South to push at, and I think it means clamping down on oil once again, a King of the North. The King of the North comes like a whirlwind to occupy Palestine and to overthrow, and that means bombs and smart bombs and who knows what kinds of weapons until they surrender, many countries in the Middle East. The only ones that escape are immediately to the east of Israel, probably Jordan, and they have managed to escape during many of these wars, and of course there again, King Hussein has no real options because in exactly 10 minutes the Israelis could wipe out Aqaba, the port that shares this northern end of the Red Sea, the little tongue of it there, with Eilat, and he only has that one port that gives him any kind of access to shipping. So he really has no choice. But as I see that there is to become ensconced in a temple in Jerusalem, an individual mentioned in the second chapter of 2 Thessalonians as the man of sin who will exalt himself above all that is worshipped and will claim that he has not just the powers of God, but that he is God and will be there as a prince of peace in order to bring peace. I think of the marriage between the only nation that you know of on the earth today that is called the Fatherland. And the only church you know of on the earth today that is called the Mother Church. And I look at the prophecies that show a woman in the 17th chapter of Revelation, depicted as a great fallen woman who has harlot daughters who came out of her, who is sitting astride the beast, guiding it, pulling, tugging, directing, forcing it to do her will. And that is depicted in the 17th as well as the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. It tells how the beast is going to hate the whore and make her desolate and turn upon her and blame her for the terrible troubles that get started as a result of the Battle of Armageddon. So when I see all of these things in the Middle East that are gradually shaping up today, and I see the most traveled pope in the history of the earth going for the first time ever to the nation of Lebanon, adjacent, the next border north of Israel, it makes me wonder how close are we. When I have books that tell me about Jewish organizations that are absolutely determined they're going to build a temple, when I have information that tells me that there is a search for the red heifer and for a Levitical priesthood, when I look at these prophecies, I see the moves of the Pope, I see all the potential for warfare in the Middle East, then I say to myself, it is near. It is coming. Is it this year, next year, 2 years, 3 years? I don't know. I'm looking at events. Christ said, when you see the abomination of desolation stand in Jerusalem, in the holy place where it ought not, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, and here is the prophecy about how that's going to come to pass, then know that the destruction thereof is nigh. then it makes me wonder, what about all these other people? What about all of our brethren? Names of families that many of you would recognize. Will they, too, when they turn on their television set some fine morning and find out that a major war has broken out in the Middle East and that tens or hundreds of thousands of Israeli citizens have been gassed or poisoned or given a terrible disease like bubonic plague or anthrax as a result of missile attacks carrying canisters of biological or chemical warfare? Are they going to be then shocked into an awareness, and are they going to get on their knees and tearfully repent before God for having been led astray and allowing themselves to just abandon everything that they believe? Will they awake to the reality of that moment, or is it too late for them? I don't know. But I do know that when I see these events, I immediately turn to the Word of God. I immediately think of these prophecies. I think of all that I have learned and studied over these many, many years. I think of some of the players on the scene whom I have met personally, of people with whom I have had a certain rapport and was able to call Yitzhak Rabin a friend, in a sense, because I'd seen him on at least three different occasions and shared a podium with him and had lunch with him and this and that. And also the things that I said in private, which I've revealed for the first time in a booklet that we have recently gotten ready, I think is going to be published very shortly, about how I told Anwar Sadat, you ought to just go to Israel. You ought to get in your airplane and just go there. 3 months after I had that long discussion with him, in overriding some of his objections about his fear of being overthrown from within, or whether or not he would be rebuffed by Begin or the Israelis wouldn't receive him, I told him he could go down in history as the greatest Egyptian leader in all of history and a man of real peace if he would do that. 3 months after my discussion with Anwar Sadat, he made a surprise visit to Jerusalem. The Camp David Accords were a direct result of that, and the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, a direct result of the Camp David Accords. So I can't help but wonder if there was, in some small measure, the planting of the seed of a thought that finally took root and blossomed in his mind. He may never have remembered the conversation himself when he finally decided to make that surprise visit, but it did happen. So I'm just trying to remind us of where we are, the times in which we live, because I know that there is a tendency for some to say, well, these things go in cycles. Doesn't the Bible prophesy that they will say things happen as they did from the beginning of time, that it just a war and then peace and a war and peace and nothing is really new and different, nothing is changing? And my answer to that is no, it isn't just a cycle, because you and I have never lived before in a world where there are many nations with active programs, with scientists and others locked away in secret places that are labeled chemicals or pesticides or anything from fly spray to herbicides or fungicides and bactericides that they're using to provide the medical facilities or perhaps even their farmers for their crops, when in fact they are manufacturing deadly biological and chemical agents which can be used to annihilate hundreds of thousands of helpless human beings. We live in those days. We live in the days of nuclear proliferation, as we well know. And we live in the days where there is a tremendous amount of hatred and anger in the Middle East. Here is the Pope, injecting himself into the middle of one of the worst nations with one of the worst histories of civil war that you can imagine, with four major antagonists over there. The Maronite Christians represent about 45% of the population. The Druze, while in a minority, are nevertheless a significant spiritual group. They are, by the way, the Unitarians of the Arab world. They believe in seven different appearances or seven different kind of manifestations of their idea of the Godhead, and they include Jesus as well as Muhammad among those, but they are a secret religion, and they believe in the transmigration of souls, and they believe that people that live a very bad life come back as dogs and camels, and people that live a good life come back as better men. And you will see the intelligentsia, of which there are about 14% of them that are allowed to wear white turbans. They are a factor over there. Then there are, of course, the Islamic adherents, and they're divided in between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And here is a nation filled with rancor and anger that is, in a sense, occupied. There are Syrian forces and Syrian influence deep in the Bekaa Valley, as Israel well knows, as well as Iranian groups of the Hezbollah that are financed by Iran. And the Pope is injecting himself in there with 20,000 armed soldiers in an armed cavalcade of armored cars with submachine guns plainly visible going down the streets of Beirut just yesterday, and then reading his speech about peace and brotherly love. I find it significant, and I hope that you do as well.